Site 7. Disclosure by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 288. Fernandez laid a restraining hand on his arm.
Ben,
she said calmly, is this a formal offer of reconciliation and return to the company?
Yes, Louise.
And what are the sweeteners?
No sweeteners. Everybody just goes back to work.
The reason I ask, Fernandez said, is that I believe I can successfully argue that Mr. Sanders was aware the tape was being made, and thus it is indeed admissible. I will argue further that it is admissible under discovery of public records over common carriers as defined in Waller versus Herbst. I will argue further that the company knew of Ms. Johnson's long history of harassment and has failed to take proper steps to investigate her behavior, either prior to this incident or now. And I will argue that the company was derelict in protecting Mr. Sanders' reputation when it leaked the story to Connie Walsh.
Wait a minute here.
I will argue that the company had a clear reason for leaking it. They desired to cheat Mr. Sanders out of his well-deserved reward for more than a decade of service to the company. And you've got an employee in Ms. Johnson who has had some trouble before. I will claim defamation and ask for punitive damages of sufficient magnitude to send a message to corporate America. I'll ask for $60 million, Ben, and you'll settle for $40 million the minute I get the judge to allow the jury to hear this tape. Because we both know that when the jury hears that tape, they will take about 5 seconds to find against Ms. Johnson and the company.
Heller shook his head. You've got a lot of long shots there, Louise. I don't think they'll ever let that tape be played in court. And you're talking about 3 years from now.
Fernandez nodded slowly. Yes, she said. 3 years is a long time.
You're telling me, Louise, anything can happen.
Yes, and frankly, I'm worried about that tape. So many untoward things can happen with evidence that is so scandalous. I can't guarantee somebody hasn't made a copy already. It'd be terrible if one fell into the hands of KQEM and they started playing it over the radio.
Christ, Heller said. Louise, I can't believe you said that.
Said what? I'm merely expressing my legitimate fears, Fernandez said. I'd be derelict if I did not let you know my concerns. Let's face facts here, Ben. The cat's out of the bag. The press already has this story. Somebody leaked it to Connie Walsh. And she printed a story that's very damaging to Mr. Sanders' reputation. And it seems that somebody is still leaking because now Connie is planning to write some unfounded speculation about physical violence by my client. It's unfortunate that someone on your side should have chosen to talk about this case. But we both know how it is with a hot story in the press. You never know where the next leak will come from.
Heller was uneasy. He glanced back at the others by the fountain. Louise, I don't think there's any movement over there.
Well, just talk to them.
Heller shrugged and walked back.
What do we do now? Sanders said. We go back to your office.
We?
Yes, Fernandez said. This isn't the end. More is going to happen today, and I want to be there when it does.
Driving back, Blackburn talked on the car phone with Garvin.
The mediation's over. We called it off.
And?
We're pushing Sanders hard to go back to work, but he's not responding so far. He's hanging tough. Now he's threatening punitive damages of $60 million.
Christ, Garvin said. Punitive damages on what basis?
Defamation from corporate negligence dealing with the fact that we supposedly knew that Johnson had a history of harassment.
I never knew of any history, Garvin said. Did you know of any history, Phil?
No, Blackburn said.
Is there any documentary evidence of such a history?
No, Blackburn said. I'm sure there isn't.
Good. Then let him threaten. Where did you leave it with Sanders?
We gave him until tomorrow morning to rejoin the company at his old job or get out.
All right, Garvin said. Now let's get serious. What have we got on him?
We're working on that felony charge, Blackburn said. It's early, but I think it's promising.
What about women?
There isn't any record on women. I know Sanders was screwing one of his assistants a couple of years back, but we can't find the records in the computer. I think he went in and erased them.
How could he? We blocked his access.
He must have done it some time ago. He's a cagey guy.
Why the hell would he do it some time ago, Phil? He had no reason to expect any of this.
I know, but we can't find the records now.
Blackburn paused.
Bob, I think we should move up the press conference.
To when?
Late tomorrow.
Good idea, Garvin said. I'll arrange it. We could even do it noon tomorrow. John Marden is flying in the morning, he said, referring to Conley White's CEO. That'll work out fine.
Sanders is planning to string this out until Friday, Blackburn said. Let's just beat him to the punch. We've got him blocked as it is. He can't get into the company files. He can't get access to Conrad or anything else. He's isolated. He can't possibly come up with anything damaging between now and tomorrow.
Fine, Garvin said. What about the reporter?
I think she'll break the story on Friday, Blackburn said. She already has it, I don't know where from. But she won't be able to resist trashing Sanders. It's too good a story. She'll go with it. And he'll be dead meat when she does.
That's fine, Garvin said.
Meredith Johnson came off the fifth-floor elevator at Digicom and ran into Ed Nichols.
We missed you at the morning meetings, Nichols said.
Yeah, I had some things to take care of, she said.
Anything I should know?
No, she said. It's boring. Just some technical matters about tax exemptions in Ireland. The Irish government wants to expand local content at the Cork plant, and we're not sure we can. This has been going on for more than a year.
You look a little tired, Nichols said, with concern. A little pale.
I'm okay. I'll be happy when this is all over.
We all will, Nichols said. You have time for dinner?
Maybe Friday night if you're still in town, she said.
She smiled.
But really, Ed, it's just tax stuff.
Okay, I believe you. He waved and went down the hallway. Johnson went into her office.
She found Stephanie Kaplan there, working at the computer terminal on Johnson's desk. Kaplan looked embarrassed.
Sorry to use your computer. I was just running over some accounts while I waited for you.
Johnson threw her purse on the couch.
Listen, Stephanie, she said. Let's get something straight right now. I'm running this division, and nobody's going to change that. And as far as I'm concerned, this is the time when a new vice president decides who's on their side and who isn't. Somebody supports me, I'll remember. Somebody doesn't, I'll deal with that too. Do we understand each other?
Kaplan came around the desk.
Yes, sure, Meredith. Don't fuck with me.
Never entered my mind, Meredith.
Good, thank you, Stephanie.
No problem, Meredith.
Kaplan left the office. Johnson closed the door behind her and went directly to her computer terminal and stared intently at the screen. Sanders walked through the corridors of Digicom with a sense of unreality. He felt like a stranger. The people who passed him in the halls looked away and rushed past him, saying nothing.
I don't exist, he said to Fernandez. Never mind, she said.
They passed the main part of the floor, where people worked in chest-high cubicles. Several pig grunts were heard. One person sang softly,
Because I used to fuck her, but it's all over now.
Sanders stopped and turned toward the singing. Fernandez grabbed his arm.
Never mind, she said.
But Christ,
don't make it worse than it is.
They passed the coffee machine. Beside it, someone had taped up a picture of Sanders. They had used it for a dartboard.
Jesus. Keep going.
As he came to the corridor leading to his office, he saw Don Cherry coming the other way.
Hi, Don. You screwed up bad on this one, Tom.
He shook his head and walked on.
Even Don Cherry.
Sanders sighed.
You knew this was going to happen, Fernandez said.
Maybe.
You did. This is the way it works.
Outside his office, Cindy stood up when she saw him. She said,
Tom, Mary Ann asked you to call her as soon as you got in.
Okay.
And Stephanie said to say never mind. She found out whatever she needed to know. She said, not to call her.
Okay.
He went in the office and closed the door. He sat down behind his desk and Fernandez sat opposite him. She took her cellular phone out of her briefcase and dialed.
Let's get one thing squared away. Miss Vries's office, please. Luis Fernandez calling.
She cupped her hand over the phone.
This shouldn't take... Oh, Eleanor? Hi, Luis Fernandez. I'm calling you about Connie Walsh.
Uh-huh. I'm sure you've been going over it with her.
Yes, I know she feels strongly. Eleanor, I just wanted to confirm to you that there is a tape of the event, and it substantiates Mr. Sanders' version rather than Ms. Johnson's.
Actually, yes, I could do that.
Entirely off the record?
Yes, I could.
Well, the problem with Walsh's source is that the company now has huge liability, and if you print a story that's wrong, even if you got it from a source, I think they have an action against you.
Oh, yes, I think absolutely Mr. Blackburn would sue. He wouldn't have any choice.
Why don't you...
I see.
Uh-huh.
Well, that could change, Eleanor.
Uh-huh. And don't forget that Mr. Sanders is considering defamation right now, based on the Mr. Piggy piece.
Yes. Why don't you do that?
Thank you.
She hung up and turned to Sanders.
We went to law school together. Eleanor is very competent and very conservative. She'd never have allowed the story in the first place and would never have considered it now if she didn't place a lot of reliance on Connie's source.
Meaning?
I'm pretty sure I know who gave her the story, Fernandez said.
She was dialing again.
Who?
Sanders said.
Right now, the important thing is Meredith Johnson. We've got to document the pattern to demonstrate that she has harassed employees before. Somehow, we've got to break this deadlock with Conrad Computer.
She turned away.
Harry?
Louise, did you talk to Conrad?
Uh-huh.
And?
A pause. She shook her head irritably.
Did you explain to them about their liabilities?
Uh-huh.
Hell. So what's our next move?
Because we've got a time problem here, Harry. That's what I'm concerned about.
While she was talking, Sanders turned to his monitor. The email light was flashing. He clicked it. You have 17 messages waiting.
Christ. He could only imagine.
He clicked the read button. They flashed up in order. From Don Cherry, Corridor Programming Team, to All Subjects. We have delivered the VIE unit to Conley White's people. The unit is now active into their company DB since they gave us the hooks today. John Conley asked that it be delivered to a suite at the Four Seasons Hotel because their CEO is arriving Thursday morning and we'll see it then. Another programming triumph brought to you by the swell folks at VIE. Don the Magnificent. Sanders flipped to the next one. From Diagnostics Group. To APG team. Analysis of Twinkle drives. The problem with the controller timing loop does not seem to come from the chip itself. We verified micro fluctuations in current from the power unit, which was apparently etched with substandard or inadequate resistances on the board, but this is minor and does not explain our failure to meet specs. Analysis is continuing. Sanders viewed the message with a sense of detachment. It didn't really tell him anything, just words that concealed the underlying truth. They still didn't know what the problem was. At another time, he'd be on his way down to the diagnostics team to ride them hard to get to the bottom of it. But now, he shrugged and went to the next message. From Baseball Central to All Players, re New Summer Softball Schedule. Download file BB.72 to get the new revised summer schedule. See you on the field.
He heard Fernandez say on the phone, Harry, we've got to crack this one somehow. What time do they close their offices in Sunnyvale?
Sanders went to the next message.
No more group messages. Do you want to read personal messages?
He clicked the icon.
Why don't you just admit you are gay?
Unsigned.
He didn't bother to see where it had come from. They would probably have manually entered it as coming from Garvin's address or something like that. He could check the real address inside the system, but not without the access privileges they had taken away. He went to the next message.
She's better looking than your assistant, and you didn't seem to mind screwing her.
Unsigned.
Sanders clicked to the next one.
You slimy weasel, get out of this company.
Your best advice.
Christ, he thought.
The next one.
Little Tommy had a pecker he played with every day. But when a lady tried to touch it, little Tommy said go away.
The verses ran on down to the bottom of the screen, but Sanders didn't read the rest. He clicked and went on. If you weren't fucking your daughter so much, you might be able to... He clicked again. He was clicking faster and faster, going through the messages. Guys like you give men a bad name, you asshole. Boris. Click. You filthy, lying male pig. Click. High time somebody stuck it to the whining bitches. I'm tired of the way they blame everybody but theirselves. Tits and blame are sex-linked traits. They're both on the X chromosome. Keep on truckin'. He went through them, no longer reading. Eventually, he was going so fast he almost missed one of the later ones. Just received word that Muhammad Jafar is dying. He's still in the hospital and not expected to survive until morning. I guess maybe there's something to this sorcery business after all. Arthur Kahn. Sanders stared at the screen. A man dying of sorcery? He couldn't begin to imagine what had really happened. The very idea seemed to belong to another world, not his. He heard Fernandez say, "I don't care, Harry, but Conrad has information relevant to the pattern, and somehow we have to get it out of them." Sanders clicked to the final message. "You're checking the wrong company. A friend." Sanders twisted the monitor around so Fernandez could see it. She frowned as she talked on the phone. "Harry, I got to go. Do what you can." She hung up. "What does it mean, we're checking the wrong company? How does this friend even know what we're doing? When did this come in?" Sanders looked at the message headers. 1:20 this afternoon. Fernandez made a note on her legal pad. "That was about the time Alan was talking to Conrad, and Conrad called Digicom, remember? So this message has to be coming from inside Digicom. But it's on the Internet. Wherever it appears to be coming from, it's actually from somebody inside the company trying to help you." His immediate thought, out of nowhere, was Max. But that didn't make any sense. Dorfman was tricky, but not in this way. Besides, Max wasn't knowledgeable about the minute-to-minute workings of the company. No, this was somebody who wanted to help Sanders, but who didn't want the help to be traced back. "You're checking the wrong company," he repeated aloud. Could it be someone at Conley White? Hell, he thought it could be anybody. "What does it mean, we're checking the wrong company?" he said. "We're checking all her past employers, and we're having a very difficult..." He stopped. "You're checking the wrong company." "I must be an idiot," he said. He started typing at his computer. "What is it?" Fernandez said. "They've restricted my access, but I still should be able to get this," he said, typing quickly. "Get what?" she said, puzzled. "You say harassers have a pattern, right?"
"Right."
"It shows up again and again, right?"
"Right."
"And we're checking her past employers to get information about past episodes of harassment."
"Right."
"And failing." "Yes, but the thing is," Sanders said, "she's worked here for the last 4 years, Louise. We're checking the wrong company." He watched as the computer terminal flashed. "Searching database." And then after a moment, he turned the screen so Fernandez could see. "Digital Communications Data Reference Search Report. DB4. Human Resources. Paren, sub 5/employee records. Paren. Search criteria. 1. Disposition. Terminated A/O, transferred A/O, resigned. 2. Supervisor. Johnson, Meredith. 3. Other criteria. Males only. Summary search results. Michael Tate, 5989. Terminate. Drug use. HR, Ref Med. Edwin Sheen, 7589. Resign. Alt Employment, D Silicon. William Rogan, 11989. Transfer, on request, Austin. Frederick Cohen, 4290. Resign. Alt Employment, Squire SX. Robert Ely, 6190, transfer, on request, Seattle. Michael Bax, 81190, transfer, own request, Malaysia. Peter Saltz, 1491, resign, alt employment, Novell. Ross Wald, 8591, transfer, own request, Cork. Richard Jackson, 111491, resign, alt employment, Aldous. James French, 2292, transfer, own request, Austin. Fernandez scanned the list.
Looks like working for Meredith Johnson can be hazardous to your job. You're looking at the classic pattern. People last only a few months and then resign or ask to be transferred elsewhere. Everything voluntary. Nobody ever fired because that might trigger a wrongful termination suit. Classic. You know any of these people?
No, Sanders said, shaking his head. But three of them are in Seattle, he said.
I only see one.
No, Aldous is here, and Squire Systems is out in Bellevue. So Richard Jackson and Frederick Cohen are up here, too.
You have any way to get details of termination packages on these people? She said. That would be helpful, because if the company paid anybody off, then we have a de facto case.
No. Sanders shook his head. Financial data is beyond minimal access.
Try anyway.
But what's the point? The system won't let me.
Do it, Fernandez said.
He frowned. You think they're monitoring me?
I guarantee it.
Okay. He typed in the parameters and pressed the search key. The answer came back. Financial database search is beyond level zero access. He shrugged. Just as I thought, no cigar.
But the point is, we asked the question, Fernandez said. It'll wake them right up.
Sanders was heading toward the bank of elevators when he saw Meredith coming toward him with three Conley White executives. He turned quickly, then went to the stairwell and started walking down the four flights to the street level. The stairwell was deserted. One flight below, the door opened and Stephanie Kaplan appeared and started coming up the stairs. Sanders was reluctant to speak to her. Kaplan was, after all, the chief financial officer and close to both Garvin and Blackburn. In the end, he said casually, "How's it going, Stephanie?"
"Hello, Tom."
Her nod to him was cool, reserved. Sanders continued past her, going down a few more steps when he heard her say,
"I'm sorry this is so difficult for you."
He paused. Kaplan was one flight above him looking down. There was no one else in the stairwell. He said, "I'm managing."
"I know you are, but still, it must be hard. So much going on at once and nobody giving you information. It must be confusing to try to figure everything out."
"Nobody giving you information?" "Well, yes," he said, speaking slowly. "It is hard to figure things out, Stephanie." She nodded.
"I remember when I first started out in business," she said. "I had a woman friend who got a very good job in a company that didn't usually hire women executives. In her new position, she had a lot of stress and crises. She was proud of the way she was dealing with the problems. But it turned out she'd only been hired because there was a financial scandal in her division, and from the beginning they were setting her up to take the fall. Her job was never about any of the things she thought it was. She was a patsy, and she was looking the wrong way when they fired her."
Sanders stared at her.
Why was she telling him this?
He said, "That's an interesting story." Kaplan nodded.
"I've never forgotten it," she said.
On the stairs above, a door clanged open and they heard footsteps descending. Without another word, Kaplan turned and continued up. Shaking his head, Sanders continued down. In the newsroom of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Connie Walsh looked up from her computer terminal and said,
"You've got to be kidding."
"No, I'm not," Eleanor Vries said, standing over her. "I'm killing this story."
She dropped the printout back on Walsh's desk.
"But you know who my source is," Walsh said. "And you know Jake was listening in to the entire conversation. We have very good notes, Eleanor. Very complete notes."
"I know."
"So, given the source, how can the company possibly sue?" Walsh said. "Eleanor, I have the fucking story."
"You have a story, and the paper faces a substantial exposure already.
Already? From what?
The Mr. Piggy column.
Oh, for Christ's sake, there's no way to claim identification from that column.
Breeze pulled out a Xerox of the column. She had marked several passages in yellow highlighter. Company X is said to be a high-tech company in Seattle that just named a woman to a high position. Mr. Piggy is said to be her subordinate. He is said to have brought a sexual harassment action. Mr. Piggy's wife is an attorney with young children. You say Mr. Piggy's charge is without merit, that he is a drunk and a womanizer. I think Sanders can absolutely claim identification and sue for defamation.
But this is a column, an opinion piece.
This column alleges facts, and it alleges them in a sarcastic and wildly overstated manner.
It's an opinion piece. Opinion is protected.
I don't think that's certain in this case at all. I'm disturbed that I allowed this column to run in the first place. But the point is, we cannot claim to be absent malice if we allow further articles to go out.
Walsh said, "You have no guts."
"And you're very free with other people's guts," Breeze said. "The story's killed, and that's final. I'm putting it in writing with copies to you, Marge, and Tom Donatio."
Fucking lawyers. What a world we live in. This story needs to be told.
Don't screw around with this, Connie. I'm telling you. Don't.
And she walked away.
Walsh thumbed through the pages of the story. She had been working on it all afternoon, polishing it, refining it, getting it exactly right. And now she wanted the story to run. She had no patience with legal thinking. This whole idea of protecting rights was just a convenient fiction. Because when you got right down to it, legal thinking was just narrow-minded, petty, self-protective. The kind of thinking that kept the power structure firmly in place. And in the end, fear served the power structure. Fear served men in power. And if there was anything that Connie Walsh believed to be true of herself, it was that she was not afraid. After a long time, she picked up the phone and dialed a number.
KSEA-TV, good afternoon.
Miss Henley, please.
Jean Henley was a bright young reporter at Seattle's newest independent TV station. Walsh had spent many evenings with Henley discussing the problems of working in the male-dominated mass media. Henley knew the value of a hot story in building a reporter's career. This story, Walsh told herself, would be told. One way or another, it would be told. Robert Ely looked up at Sanders nervously.
"What do you want?" he asked.
Ely was young, not more than 26, a tense man with a blonde mustache. He was wearing a tie and was in his shirt sleeves. He worked in one of the partitioned cubicles at the back of Digicom's accounting department in the Gower building.
"I want to talk about Meredith," Sanders said.
Ely was one of the three Seattle residents on his list.
"Oh, God,"
Ely said. He glanced around nervously, his Adam's apple bobbed.
I don't have anything to say."
"I just want to talk," Sanders said.
"Not here," Ely said.
"Then let's go to the conference room," Sanders said.
They walked down the hall to a small conference room, but a meeting was being held there. Sanders suggested they go to a little cafeteria in the corner of accounting, but Ely told him that wouldn't be private. He was growing more nervous by the minute.
"Really, I have nothing to tell you," he kept saying. "There's nothing, really nothing."
Sanders knew he had better find a quiet place at once before Ely bolted and ran. They ended up in the men's room, white tile spotlessly clean. Ely leaned against a sink.
"I don't know why you are talking to me. I don't have anything I can tell you."
"You worked for Meredith in Cupertino?"
"Yes."
"And you left there 2 years ago?"
"Yes."
"Why did you leave?"
"Why do you think?"
Ely said in a burst of anger. His voice echoed off the tiles.
"You know why, for Christ's sake. Everybody knows why. She made my life hell."
"What happened?" Sanders asked.
"What happened?"
Ely shook his head, remembering.
"Every day. Every day. Robert, would you stay late? We have some things to go over."
After a while, I tried to make excuses.
Then she would say, "Robert, I'm not sure you're showing the proper dedication to this company."
And she would put little comments in my performance review. Subtle little negative things.
Nothing that I could complain about. But they were there, piling up. Robert, I think you need my help here. Why don't you see me after work?
Robert, why don't you drop by my apartment and we'll discuss it? I really think you should.
It was terrible. The person I was living with did not... I was in a real bind.
Did you report her?
Ely laughed harshly.
Are you kidding? She's practically a member of Garvin's family.
So you just put up with it.
Ely shrugged.
Finally, the person I was living with got another job. When he came up here, I transferred too.
I mean, of course I wanted to go. It just worked out all around.
Would you make a statement about Meredith now?
Not a chance.
You realize, Sanders said, that the reason she gets away with it is that nobody reports her.
Ely pushed away from the sink.
I have enough problems in my life without going public on this.
He went to the door, paused, and turned back.
Just so you're clear, I've got nothing to say on the subject of Meredith Johnson. If anybody asks, I'll say our working relationship was correct at all times. And I'll also say that I never met you.
Meredith Johnson?
Of course I remember her, Richard Jackson said. I worked for her for more than a year.
Sanders was in Jackson's office on the second floor of the Aldous building on the south side of Pioneer Square. Jackson was a good-looking man of 30 with the hearty manner of an ex-athlete. He was a marketing manager at Aldous. His office was friendly, cluttered with product boxes for graphics programs. IntelliDraw, Freehand, SuperPaint, and PageMaker.
Beautiful and charming woman, Jackson said. Very intelligent. Always a pleasure.
Sanders said, I was wondering why you left.
I was offered this job, that's why. And I've never regretted it. Wonderful job, wonderful company. I've had a great experience here.
Is that the only reason you left?
Jackson laughed.
You mean did Meredith Man-Muncher come on to me?
He said.
Hey, is the Pope Catholic? Is Bill Gates rich?
Of course she came on to me.
Did that have anything to do with your leaving?
No, Jackson said. Meredith came on to everybody. She's sort of an equal opportunity employer in that respect. She chased everybody. When I first started in Cupertino, she had this little gay guy she used to chase around the table. Terrorized the poor bastard. Little skinny nervous guy. Christ, she used to make him tremble.
And you?
Jackson shrugged.
I was a single guy just starting out. She was beautiful. It was okay with me.
You never had any difficulties?
Never. Meredith was fabulous. Shitty lay, of course, but you can't have everything. She's a very intelligent, very beautiful woman, always dressed great, and she liked me. So she took me to all these functions. I met people, made contacts. It was great.
So you saw nothing wrong?
Not a damn thing, Jackson said. She could get a little bossy. That got old. There were a couple of other women I was seeing, but I always had to be on call for her, even at the last minute. That could be irritating sometimes. You begin to think your life is not your own. And she's got a mean temper sometimes. But what the hell? You do what you have to do. Now I'm assistant manager here at 30. I'm doing great. Great company, great town, great future. And I owe it to her. She's great.
Sanders said, you were an employee of the company at the time that you were having your relationship, isn't that right?
Yeah, sure.
Isn't she required by company policy to report any relationship with an employee? Did she report her relationship with you?
Christ, no, Jackson said.
He leaned across his desk.
Let's get one thing straight, just between you and me. I think Meredith is great. If you have a problem with her, it's your problem. I don't know what it could be. You used to live with her, for Christ's sake, so there can't be any surprises. Meredith likes to fuck guys. She likes to tell them to do this, do that. She likes to order them around. That's who she is. And I don't see anything wrong with it.
Sanders said, I don't suppose you'd...
Make a statement?
Jackson said.
Get serious. Listen, there's a lot of bullshit around now. I hear things like, you can't go out with the people you work with.
Christ, if I couldn't go out with the people I worked with, I'd still be a virgin. That's all anybody can go out with. The people you work with. That's the only people you get to know. And sometimes those people are your superiors.
Big deal. Women screw men and get ahead. Men screw women and get ahead. Everybody's going to screw everybody else anyway, if they can, because they want to. I mean, women are just as hot as men. They want it just like we do. That's real life. But you get some people who are pissed off, so they file a complaint and say, "Oh no, you can't do that to me." I'm telling you, it's all bullshit. Like these sensitivity training seminars we all have to go to. Everybody sits there with their hands in their laps like a fucking Red Guard meeting, learning the correct way to address your fellow workers. But afterward, everybody goes out and fucks around, the same as they always did. The assistants go, "Oh, Mr. Jackson, have you been to the gym? You look so strong." Batting their eyelashes. "So what am I supposed to do? You can't make rules about this. People get hungry, they eat. Doesn't matter how many meetings they attend. This is all a gigantic jerk-off, and anybody who buys into it is an asshole." "I guess you answered my question," Sanders said. He got up to leave. Obviously, Jackson wasn't going to help him. "Look," Jackson said, "I'm sorry you've got a problem here, but everyone's too damn sensitive these days. I see people now, kids right out of college, and they really think they should never experience an unpleasant moment. Nobody should ever say anything they don't like or tell a joke they don't like. But the thing is, nobody can make the world be the way they want it to be all the time. Things always happen that embarrass you or piss you off. That's life. I hear women telling jokes about men every day. Offensive jokes, dirty jokes. I don't get bent out of shape. Life is great. Who has time for this crap? Not me." Sanders came out of the Aldous building at 5 o'clock. Tired and discouraged, he trudged back toward the Hazard building. The streets were wet, but the rain had stopped, and the afternoon sunlight was trying to break through the clouds. He was back in his office 10 minutes later. Cindy was not at her desk, and Fernandez was gone. He felt deserted and alone and hopeless. He sat down and dialed the final number on his list. "Squire Electronic Data Systems, good evening." Sanders said, "Frederick Cohen's office, please." "I'm sorry, Mr. Cohen has gone for the day." "Do you know how I could reach him?" "I'm afraid I don't. Do you want to leave voicemail?" Damn, he thought. What was the point? But he said, "Yes, please." There was a click, then, "Hi, this is Fred Cohen. Leave a message at the tone. If it's after hours, you can try me on my car phone at 502-8804 or my home at 505-9943. Sanders jotted the numbers down. He dialed the car phone first. He heard a crackle of static, then, "I know, honey, I'm sorry I'm late, but I'm on my way. I just got tied up." "Mr. Cohen?" "Oh." A pause. "Yes, this is Fred Cohen." "My name is Tom Sanders. I work over at Digicom, and..." "I know who you are." The voice sounded tense. "I understand you used to work for Meredith Johnson." "Yes, I did." "I wonder if I could talk to you."
"What about?"
"About your experiences working for her." There was a long pause. Finally, Cohen said,
"What would be the point of that?"
"Well, I'm in a sort of dispute with Meredith now, and..."
"I know you are."
"Yes, and you see, I would like to..."
"Look, Tom, I left Digicom 2 years ago. Whatever happened is ancient history now."
"Well, actually," Sanders said, "it's not, because I'm trying to establish a pattern of behavior, and..."
"I know what you're trying to do, but this is very touchy stuff, Tom. I don't want to get into it."
"If we could just talk," Sanders said, "just for a few minutes." "Tom." Cohen's voice was flat.
"Tom, I'm married now. I have a wife. She's pregnant. I don't have anything to say about Meredith Johnson. Nothing at all. But I'm sorry. I've got to go."
Click. Cindy came back in as he was hanging up the phone. She pushed a cup of coffee in front of him.
"Everything okay?"
"No," he said. "Everything is terrible." He was reluctant to admit, even to himself, that he had no more moves left. He had approached 3 men, and they had each refused to establish a pattern of behavior for him. He doubted that the other men on the list would behave differently. He found himself thinking of what his wife Susan had said 2 days before.
You have no moves.
Now, after all this effort, it turned out to be true. He was finished.
Where's Fernandez?
She's meeting with Blackburn.
What?
Cindy nodded. In the small conference room. They've been there about 15 minutes now.
Oh, Christ.
He got up from his desk and went down the hall. He saw Fernandez sitting with Blackburn in the conference room. Fernandez was making notes on her legal pad, head bent deferentially. Blackburn was running his hands down his lapels and looking upward as he spoke. He seemed to be dictating to her. Then Blackburn saw him and waved him over. Sanders went into the conference room.
Tom, Blackburn said with a smile, I was just coming to see you. Good news. I think we've been able to resolve this situation. I mean, really resolve it, once and for all.
Uh-huh, Sanders said. He didn't believe a word of it. He turned to Fernandez. Fernandez looked up from her legal pad slowly. She appeared dazed.
That's the way it looks.
Blackburn stood and faced Sanders. I can't tell you how pleased I am, Tom. I've been working on Bob all afternoon, and he's finally come to face reality. The plain fact is, the company has a problem, Tom, and we owe you a debt of gratitude for bringing it so clearly to our attention. This can't go on. Bob knows he has to deal with it, and he will.
Sanders just stared. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. But there was Fernandez, nodding and smiling.
Blackburn smoothed his tie.
But as Frank Lloyd Wright once said, God is in the details. You know, Tom, we have one small immediate problem, a political problem, having to do with the merger. We're asking your help with the briefing tomorrow for Marden, Conley's CEO. But after that? Well, you've been badly wronged, Tom. This company has wronged you. And we recognize that we have an obligation to make it up to you whatever way we can.
Still disbelieving it, Sanders said harshly, What exactly are we talking about?
Blackburn's voice was soothing. Well, Tom, at this point, that's really up to you, he said. I've given Louise the parameters of a potential deal and all the options that we would agree to. You can discuss it with her and get back to us. We'll sign any interim papers you require, of course. All that we ask in return is that you attend the meeting tomorrow and help us get through the merger. Fair enough?
Blackburn extended his hand and held it there. Sanders stared.
From the bottom of my heart, Tom, I'm sorry for all that has happened.
Sanders shook his hand.
Thank you, Tom, Blackburn said. Thank you for your patience, and thank you on behalf of this company. Now, sit down and talk with Louise and let us know what you decide.
And Blackburn left the room, closing the door softly behind him. He turned to Fernandez. What the hell is this all about? Fernandez gave a long sigh.
It's called capitulation, she said. Total and complete capitulation. Digicom just folded.
Sanders watched Blackburn walk down the hallway away from the conference room. He was filled with confused feelings. Suddenly he was being told it was all over, and over without a fight, without blood being spilled. Watching Blackburn, he had a sudden image of blood in the bathroom sink of his old apartment. And this time he remembered where it came from. A part of the chronology fell into place. Blackburn was staying at his apartment during his divorce. He was on edge and drinking too much. One day he cut himself so badly while shaving that the sink was spattered with blood. Later on, Meredith saw the blood in the sink and on the towels and said,
Did one of you guys fuck her while she was having her period?
Meredith was always blunt that way. She liked to startle people, to shock them. And then one Saturday afternoon, she walked around the apartment in white stockings and a garter belt and a bra while Phil was watching television. Sanders said to her, What are you doing that for?
Just cheering him up, Meredith replied.
She threw herself back on the bed.
Now why don't you cheer me up, she said.
And she pulled her legs back, opening.
Tom, are you listening to me?
Fernandez was saying.
Hello? Tom, are you there?
I'm here, Sanders said. But he was still watching Blackburn, thinking about Blackburn. Now he remembered another time, a few years later. Sanders had started dating Susan, and Phil had dinner with the two of them one night. Susan went to the bathroom.
"She's great," Blackburn said. "She's terrific. She's beautiful and she's great."
"But?"
"But,"
Blackburn had shrugged.
"She's a lawyer."
"So?"
"You can never trust a lawyer," Blackburn had said and laughed.
One of his rueful, wise laughs.
"You can never trust a lawyer."
Now standing in the Digicom conference room, Sanders watched as Blackburn disappeared around a corner. He turned back to Fernandez. "Really had no choice," Fernandez was saying. "The whole situation finally became untenable. The fact situation with Johnson is bad, and the tape is dangerous. They don't want it played, and they're afraid it will get out. They have a problem about prior sexual harassment by Johnson. She's done it before, and they know it. Even though none of the men you talked to has agreed to talk, one of them might in the future, and they know it. And, of course, they've got their chief counsel revealing company information to a reporter." Sanders said,
"What?"
She nodded. Blackburn was the one who gave the story to Connie Walsh. He acted in flagrant violation of all rules of conduct for an employee of the company. He's a major problem for them, and it all just became too much. These things could bring down the entire company. Looking at it rationally, they had to make a deal with you.
"Yeah," Sanders said, "but none of this is rational, you know."
"You're acting like you don't believe it," Fernandez said. "Believe it. It just got too big. They couldn't sit on it anymore."
"So what's the deal?"
Fernandez looked at her notes. "You've got your whole shopping list. They'll fire Johnson. They'll give you her job, if you want that. Or they'll reinstate you at your present position. Or they'll give you another position in the company. They'll pay you $100,000 in pain and suffering, and they'll pay my fees. Or they'll negotiate a termination agreement if you want that. In any case, they'll give you full stock options if and when the division goes public, whether you choose to remain with the company or not."
"Jesus Christ."
She nodded. "Total capitulation."
"You really believe Blackburn means it?"
"You can never trust a lawyer."
"Yes," she said. "Frankly, it's the first thing that has made any sense to me all day. They had to do this, Tom. Their exposure is too great, and the stakes are too high."
"And what about this briefing?"
"They're worried about the merger, as you suspected when all this began. They don't want to blow it with any sudden changes now. So they want you to participate in the briefing tomorrow with Johnson, as if everything was normal. Then early next week, Johnson will have a physical exam as part of her insurance for the new job. The exam will uncover serious health problems, maybe even cancer, which will force a regrettable change in management."
"I see."
He went to the window and looked out at the city. The clouds were higher, and the evening sun was breaking through. He took a deep breath.
"And if I don't participate in the briefing?"
"It's up to you, but I would if I were you," Fernandez said. "At this point, you really are in a position to bring down the company. And what good is that?" He took another deep breath. He was feeling better all the time.
"You're saying this is over," he said finally.
"Yes, it's over, and you've won. You pulled it off. Congratulations, Tom." She shook his hand.
"Jesus Christ," he said.
She stood up. "I'm going to draw up an instrument outlining my conversation with Blackburn, specifying these options, and send it to him for his signature in an hour. I'll call you when I have it signed. Meanwhile, I recommend you do whatever preparation you need for this meeting tomorrow, and get some much-deserved rest. I'll see you tomorrow."
"Okay."
It was slowly seeping into him, the realization that it was over. Really over. It had happened so suddenly and so completely, he was a little dazed. "Congratulations again," Fernandez said. She folded her briefcase and left. He was back in his office at about 6. Cindy was leaving. She asked if he needed her, and he said he didn't. Sanders sat at his desk and stared out the window for a while, savoring the conclusion of the day. Through his open door, he watched as people left for the night, heading down the hall.
Finally, he called his wife in Phoenix to tell her the news, but her line was busy. There was a knock at his door. He looked up and saw Blackburn standing there, looking apologetic.
Got a minute?
Sure.
I just wanted to repeat to you, on a personal level, how sorry I am about all this. In the press of complex corporate problems like this, human values may get lost, despite the best of intentions. While we intend to be fair to everyone, sometimes we fail. And what is a corporation if not a human group, a group of human beings? We're all people underneath it all. As Alexander Pope once said, we're all just human. So recognizing your own graciousness through all this, I want to say to you...
Sanders wasn't listening. He was tired. All he really heard was that Phil realized he had screwed up and now was trying to repair things in his usual manner by sucking up to someone he had earlier bullied. Sanders interrupted, saying, "What about Bob?" Now that it was over, Sanders was having a lot of feelings about Garvin, memories going back to his earliest days with the company. Garvin had been a kind of father to Sanders, and he wanted to hear from Garvin now. He wanted an apology, or something. "I imagine Bob's going to take a couple of days to come around," Blackburn said. "This was a very difficult decision for him to arrive at. I had to work very hard on him, on your behalf, and now he's got to figure out how to break it to Meredith, all that."
"Uh-huh.
But he'll eventually talk to you. I know he will. Meanwhile, I wanted to go over a few things about the meeting tomorrow," Blackburn said. "It's for Martin, their CEO, and it's going to be a bit more formal than the way we usually do things. We'll be in the big conference room on the ground floor. It'll start at 9 and go to 10. Meredith will chair the meeting, and she'll call on all the division heads to give a summary of progress and problems in their divisions. Mary Ann first, then Don, then Mark, then you. Everyone will talk 3 to 4 minutes. Do it standing, wear a jacket and tie. Use visuals if you have them, but stay away from technical details. Keep it an overview. In your case, they'll expect to hear mostly about Twinkle."
Sanders nodded. "All right. But there isn't really much new to report. We still haven't figured out what's wrong with the drives."
"That's fine. I don't think anybody expects a solution yet. Just emphasize the success of the prototypes and the fact that we've overcome production problems before. Keep it upbeat and keep it moving. If you have a prototype or a mock-up, you might want to bring it along."
"Okay.
You know the stuff. Bright, rosy, digital future. Minor technical glitches won't stand in the way of progress."
"Meredith's okay with that," he said.
He was slightly disturbed to hear that she was chairing the meeting.
"Meredith is expecting all the heads to be upbeat and non-technical. There won't be a problem."
"Okay," Sanders said.
"Call me tonight if you want to go over your presentation," Blackburn said.
"Or in the morning, early. Let's just finesse this session, and then we can move on. Start making changes next week."
Sanders nodded.
"You're the kind of man this company needs," Blackburn said. "I appreciate your understanding. And again, Tom, I'm sorry." He left.
Sanders called down to the diagnostics group to see if they had any further word, but there was no answer. He went to the closet behind Cindy's desk and took out the AV materials, the big schematic drawing of the Twinkle drive, and the schematic of the production line in Malaysia. He could prop these on easels while he talked. But as he thought about it, it occurred to him that Blackburn was right. A mock-up or a prototype would be good to have. In fact, he should probably bring one of the drives that Arthur had sent from KL. It reminded him that he should call Arthur in Malaysia. He dialed the number.
"Mr. Khan's office?"
"It's Tom Sanders calling." The assistant sounded surprised.
"Mr. Khan is not here, Mr. Sanders."
"When is he expected back?"
"He's out of the office, Mr. Sanders. I don't know when he'll be back."
"I see." Sanders frowned.
That was odd.
With Muhammad Jafar missing, it was unlike Arthur to leave the plant without supervision. The assistant said,
"Can I give him a message?"
"No message, thanks." He hung up, went down to the third floor to Cherry's programming group, and put his card in the slot to let himself in. The card popped back out, and the LED blinked
0000.
It took him a moment to realize that they had cut off his access. Then he remembered the other card he had picked up earlier. He pushed it in the slot and the door opened. Sanders went inside. He was surprised to find the unit deserted. The programmers all kept strange hours. There was almost always somebody there, even at midnight. He went to the diagnostics room, where the drives were being studied. There were a series of benches surrounded by electronic equipment and blackboards. The drives were set out on the benches, all covered in white cloth. The bright overhead quartz lights were off. He heard rock and roll music from an adjacent room and went there. A lone programmer in his early 20s was sitting at a console typing. Beside him, a portable radio blared. Sanders said, "Where is everybody?" The programmer looked up. "Third Wednesday of the month." "So?" "Oops meets on the third Wednesday." "Oh." The Object-Oriented Programmer Support Association, or OOPS, was an association of programmers in the Seattle area. It was started by Microsoft some years earlier and was partly social and partly trade talk. Sanders said, "You know anything about what the diagnostics team found?" "Sorry," the programmer shook his head. "I just came in." Sanders went back to the diagnostics room. He flicked on the lights and gently removed the white cloth that covered the drives. He saw that only three of the CD-ROM drives had been opened, their innards exposed to powerful magnifying glasses and electronic probes on the tables. The remaining seven drives were stacked to one side, still in plastic. He looked up at the blackboards. One had a series of equations and hastily scribbled data points. The other had a flowchart list that read, A. CONTR, incompat. BLSI, power. B. Optic disfunct, voltage reg. Arm, servo. C. Laser RO. A, B, C. D. Sigma mechanical. Check, check. E. Gremlins. It didn't mean much to Sanders. He turned his attention back to the tables and peered at the test equipment. It looked fairly standard, except that there were a series of large bore needles lying on the table, and several white circular wafers encased in plastic that looked like camera filters. There were also Polaroid pictures of the drives in various stages of disassembly. The team had documented their work. Three of the Polaroids were placed in a neat row, as if they might be significant, but Sanders couldn't see why. They just showed chips on a green circuit board. He looked at the drives themselves, being careful not to disturb anything. Then he turned to the stack of drives that were still wrapped in plastic. But looking closely, he noticed fine needlepoint punctures in the plastic covering four of the drives. Nearby was a medical syringe and an open notebook. The notebook showed a column of figures. PPU. 7. Roman numeral 2. Repeat 2. 5. 2. And at the bottom, someone had scrawled, "Fucking obvious." But it wasn't obvious to Sanders. He decided that he'd better call Don Cherry later tonight to have him explain it. In the meantime, he took one of the extra drives from the stack to use in the presentation the following morning. He left the diagnostics room carrying all his presentation materials, the easel boards flapping against his legs. He headed downstairs to the ground floor conference room, which had an AV closet where speakers stored visual material before a presentation. He could lock his material away there. In the lobby, he passed the receptionist's desk, now manned by a black security guard who watched a baseball game and nodded to Sanders. Sanders went back toward the rear of the floor, moving quietly on the plush carpeting. The hallway was dark, but the lights were on in the conference room. He could see them shining from around the corner. As he came closer, he heard Meredith Johnson say, "And then what?" And a man's voice answered something indistinct. Sanders paused. He stood in the dark corridor and listened. From where he stood, he could see nothing of the room. There was a moment of silence, and then Johnson said, "Okay, so will Mark talk about design?"
The man said, "Yes, he'll cover that."
"Okay," Johnson said. "Then what about the..."
Sanders couldn't hear the rest. He crept forward, moving silently on the carpet, and cautiously peered around the corner. He still could not see into the conference room itself, but there was a large chrome sculpture in the hallway outside the room, a sort of propeller shape, and in the reflection of its polished surface, he saw Meredith moving in the room. The man with her was Blackburn. Johnson said,
"So what if Sanders doesn't bring it up?"
"He will,"
Blackburn said. "You're sure he doesn't... that the..." Again the rest was lost. "No, he..."
"No idea."
Sanders held his breath. Meredith was pacing, her image in the reflection twisting and distorted.
"So when he does, I will say that this is a..."
"Is that, you mean?"
"Exactly," Blackburn said.
"And if he..."
Blackburn put his hand on her shoulder.
"Yes, you have to."
"So, want me to?"
Blackburn said something quiet in reply, and Sanders heard none of it except the phrase,
"Must demolish him."
"Can do that."
"Make sure. Counting on you."
There was the shrill sound of a telephone. Both Meredith and Blackburn reached for their pockets. Meredith answered the call, and the two began to move toward the exit. They were heading toward Sanders. Panicked, Sanders looked around and saw a men's room to his right. He slipped inside the door as they came out of the conference room and started down the hallway.
"Don't worry about this, Meredith," Blackburn said. "It'll go fine."
"I'm not worried," she said.
"It should be quite smooth and impersonal," Blackburn said. "There's no reason for rancor. After all, you have the facts on your side. He's clearly incompetent."
"He still can't get into the database," she said.
"No, he's locked out of the system."
"And there's no way he can get into Conley White's system?"
Blackburn laughed.
"No way in hell, Meredith."
The voices faded, moving down the hallway. Sanders strained to listen, finally heard the click of a door closing. He stepped out of the bathroom into the hallway. The hallway was deserted. He stared toward the far door. His own telephone rang in his pocket, the sound so loud it made him jump. He answered it.
"Sanders?" "Listen," Fernandez said. "I sent the draft of your contract to Blackburn's office, but it came back with a couple of added statements that I'm not sure about. I think we better meet to discuss them."
"In an hour," Sanders said.
"Why not now?"
"I have something to do first," he said.
"Ah, Thomas!"
Max Dorfman opened the door to his hotel room and immediately wheeled away, back toward the television set.
"You have finally decided to come."
"You've heard?"
"Heard what?" Dorfman said. "I'm an old man. No one bothers with me anymore. I'm cast by the wayside. By everyone, including you."
He clicked off the television set and grinned. Sanders said, "What have you heard?"
"Oh, just a few things. Rumors, idle talk. Why don't you tell me yourself?"
"I'm in trouble, Max."
"Of course you are in trouble," Dorfman snorted. "You have been in trouble all week. You only noticed now?"
"They're setting me up."
"They?"
"Blackburn and Meredith."
"Nonsense."
"It's true."
"You believe Blackburn can set you up? Philip Blackburn is a spineless fool. He has no principles and almost no brains. I told Garvin to fire him years ago. Blackburn is incapable of original thought."
"Then Meredith."
"Ah, Meredith. Yes, so beautiful. Such lovely breasts."
"Max, please."
"You thought so, too, once."
"That was a long time ago," Sanders said.
Dorfman smiled.
"Times have changed,"
he said, with heavy irony.
"What does that mean?"
"You are looking pale, Thomas."
"I can't figure anything out. I'm scared."
"Oh, you're scared. A big man like you is scared of this beautiful woman with beautiful breasts."
"Max..."
"Of course, you are right to be scared. She has done all these many terrible things to you. She has tricked you and manipulated you and abused you, yes?"
"Yes," Sanders said.
"You have been victimized by her and Garvin."
"Yes."
"Then why were you mentioning to me the flower,
He frowned. For a moment he didn't know what Dorfman was talking about. The old man was always so confusing, and he liked to be...
The flower,
Dorfman said irritably, rapping his knuckles on the wheelchair arm.
The stained glass flower in your apartment. We were speaking of it the other day. Don't tell me you have forgotten it.
The truth was that he had, until that moment. Then he remembered the image of the stained glass flower, the image that had come unbidden to his mind a few days earlier.
You're right. I forgot.
You forgot? Dorfman's voice was heavy with sarcasm. You expect me to believe that?
Max, I did.
He snorted.
You are impossible. I cannot believe you will behave so transparently. You didn't forget, Thomas. You merely chose not to confront it.
Confront what?
In his mind, Sanders saw the stained glass flower in bright orange and purple and yellow. The flower mounted in the door of his apartment. Earlier in the week, he had been thinking about it constantly, almost obsessing about it, and yet today...
I cannot bear this charade, Dorfman said. Of course you remember it all, but you are determined not to think of it.
Sanders shook his head, confused.
Thomas, you told it all to me 10 years ago, Dorfman said, waving his hand. You confided in me. Blubbering, you were very upset at the time. It was the most important thing in your life at the time. Now you say it is all forgotten?
He shook his head.
You told me that you would take trips with Garvin to Japan and Korea, and when you returned, she would be waiting for you in the apartment, in some erotic costume or whatever, some erotic pose. And you told me that sometimes, when you got home, you would see her first through the stained glass. Isn't that what you told me, Thomas? Or do I have it wrong?
He had it wrong. It came back to Sanders in a rush then, like a picture zooming large and bright before his eyes. He saw everything, almost as if he were there once again. The steps leading up to his apartment on the second floor, and the sounds he heard as he went up the steps in the middle of the afternoon, sounds he could not identify at first, but then he realized what he was hearing as he came to the landing and looked in through the stained glass and he saw...
I came back a day early, Sanders said.
Yes, that's right. You came back unexpectedly.
The glass in patterns of yellow and orange and purple. And through it, her naked back moving up and down. She was in the living room, on the couch, moving up and down.
And what did you do, Dorfman said, when you saw her?
I rang the bell.
That's right. Very civilized of you. Very non-confrontational and polite. You rang the bell.
In his mind, he saw Meredith turning, looking toward the door, her tangled hair falling across her face. She brushed the hair away from her eyes. Her expression changed as she saw him. Her eyes widened. Dorfman prodded.
And then what? What did you do?
I left, Sanders said. I went to the garage and got in my car. I drove for a while. A couple of hours, maybe more. It was dark when I got back.
You were upset, naturally.
He came back up the stairs and again looked in through the stained glass. The living room was empty. He unlocked the door and entered the living room. There was a bowl of popcorn on the couch. The couch was creased. The television was on, soundless. He looked away from the couch and went into the bedroom, calling her name. He found her packing her open suitcase on the bed. He said,
"What are you doing?"
"Leaving," she said.
She turned to face him. Her body was rigid, tense.
"Isn't that what you want me to do?"
"I don't know," he said.
And then she burst into tears, sobbing, reaching for a Kleenex, blowing her nose loudly, awkwardly, like a child. And somehow in her distress he held his arms out, and she hugged him and said she was sorry, repeating the words again and again through her tears, looking up at him, touching his face. And then somehow...
Dorfman cackled. "Right on the suitcase, yes? Right there on the suitcase, on her clothes that were being packed, you made your reconciliation."
"Yes," Sanders said, remembering.
"She aroused you. You wanted her back. She excited you. She challenged you. You wanted to possess her."
"Yes."
"Love is wonderful," Dorfman sighed, sarcastic again. "So pure. so innocent. And then you were together again, is that right?
Yes, for a while, but it didn't work out. It was odd how it had finally ended. He had been so angry with her at first, but he had forgiven her, and he thought they could go on. They had talked about their feelings, they had expressed their love, and he had tried to go on with the best will in the world. But in the end, neither of them could. The incident had fatally ruptured the relationship, and something vital had been torn from it. It didn't matter how often they told themselves that they could go on. Something else now ruled. The core was dead. They fought more often, managing in this way to sustain the old energy for a while. But finally, it just ended.
And when it was over, Dorfman said, that was when you came and talked to me.
Yes, Sanders said.
And what did you come to talk to me about? Dorfman asked. Or have you forgotten that, too?
No, I remember. I wanted your advice. He had gone to Dorfman because he was considering leaving Cupertino. He was breaking up with Meredith, his life was confused, everything was in disarray, and he wanted to make a fresh start, to go somewhere else. So he was considering moving to Seattle to head the Advanced Projects Division. Garvin had offered him the job in passing one day, and Sanders was thinking about taking it. He had asked Dorfman's advice.
You were quite upset, Dorfman said. It was an unhappy ending to a love affair.
Yes.
So you might say that Meredith Johnson is the reason you are here in Seattle, Dorfman said. Because of her, you changed your career, your life. You made a new life here, and many people knew this fact of your past. Garvin knew, and Blackburn knew. That is why he was so careful to ask you if you could work with her. Everyone was so worried about how it would be. But you reassured them, Thomas, didn't you?
Yes.
And your reassurances were false.
Sanders hesitated.
I don't know, Max. Come now, you know exactly. It must have been like a bad dream, a nightmare from your past, to hear that this person you had run away from was now coming to Seattle, pursuing you up here, and that she would be your superior in the company, taking the job that you wanted, that you thought you deserved.
I don't know.
Don't you? In your place, I would be angry. I would want to be rid of her, yes? She hurt you once very badly, and you would not want to be hurt again. But what choice did you have? She had the job, and she was Garvin's protege. She was protected by Garvin's power, and he would not hear a word against her. True?
True.
And for many years, you had not been close to Garvin, because Garvin didn't really want you to take the Seattle job in the first place. He had offered it to you, expecting you to turn it down. Garvin likes protégés. He likes admirers at his feet. He does not like his admirers to pack up and leave for another city. So Garvin was disappointed with you. Things were never the same. And now suddenly here was this woman out of your past, a woman with Garvin's backing. So what choice did you have? What could you do with your anger?
His mind was spinning, confused. When he thought back to the events of that first day, the rumors, the announcement by Blackburn, the first meeting with her, he did not remember feeling anger. His feelings had been so complicated on that day, but he had not felt anger. He was sure of it.
Thomas, Thomas, stop dreaming. There is no time for it.
Sanders was shaking his head. He couldn't think clearly.
Thomas, you arranged all this. Whether you admit it or not, whether you are aware of it or not, on some level what has happened is exactly what you intended. And you made sure it would happen.
He found himself remembering Susan. What had she said at the restaurant? Why didn't you tell me? I could have helped you. And she was right, of course. She was an attorney. She could have advised him if he had told her what happened the first night. She would have told him what to do. She could have gotten him out of it. But he hadn't told her. There's not much we can do now.
You wanted this confrontation, Thomas.
And then Garvin. She was your girlfriend, and you didn't like it when she dropped you. So now you want to pay her back.
You worked all week to ensure this confrontation.
Max.
So don't tell me you are a victim here. You're not a victim. You call yourself a victim because you don't want to take responsibility for your life. Because you are sentimental and lazy and naive. You think other people should take care of you.
Jesus, Max, Sanders said.
You deny your part in this. You pretend to forget. You pretend to be unaware. And now you pretend to be confused.
Max.
Oh, I don't know why I bother with you. How many hours do you have until this meeting? 12 hours? 10? Yet you waste your time talking to a crazy old man.
He spun in his wheelchair.
If I were you, I would get to work.
Meaning what?
Well, we know what your intentions are, Thomas. But what are her intentions, She is solving a problem, too. She has a purpose here. So, what is the problem she is solving?
I don't know, Sanders said.
Clearly. But how will you find out?
Lost in thought, he walked the 5 blocks to Il Terrazzo. Fernandez was waiting for him outside. They went in together. Oh, Christ, Sanders said as he looked around. All the usual suspects, Fernandez said. In the far section straight ahead, Meredith Johnson was having dinner with Bob Garvin. 2 tables away, Phil Blackburn was eating with his wife, Doris, a thin, bespectacled woman who looked like an accountant. Near them, Stephanie Kaplan was having dinner with a young man in his 20s. Probably her son at the university, Sanders thought. And over to the right, by the window, the Conley White people were in the midst of a working dinner, their briefcases open at their feet, papers scattered all over the table. Ed Nichols sat with John Conley to his right and Jim Daly to his left. Daly was speaking into a tiny dictating machine.
Maybe we should go somewhere else, Sanders said.
No, Fernandez said. They've already seen us. We can sit in the corner over there.
Carmine came over.
Mr. Sanders,
he said with a formal nod.
We'd like a table in the corner, Carmine.
Yes, of course, Mr. Sanders.
They sat to one side. Fernandez was staring at Meredith and Garvin.
She could be his daughter, she said.
Everybody says so.
It's quite striking.
The waiter brought menus. Nothing on it appealed to Sanders, but they ordered anyway. Fernandez was looking steadily at Garvin.
He's a fighter, isn't he?
Bob? Famous fighter. Famous tough guy.
She knows how to play him.
Fernandez turned away and pulled papers out of her briefcase.
This is the contract that Blackburn sent back. It is all in order, except for 2 clauses. First, they claim the right to terminate you if you are shown to have committed a felony on the job.
Uh-huh. He wondered what they might mean. And the second clause claims the right to terminate you if you have failed to demonstrate satisfactory performance in the job as measured by industry standards.
What does that mean?
He shook his head. They must have something in mind. He told her about the conversation he had overheard in the conference room. As usual, Fernandez showed no reaction.
Possible, she said.
Possible? They're going to do it.
I meant legally. It's possible that they intend something of this sort, and it would work.
Why?
A harassment claim brings up the entire performance of an employee. If there is dereliction, even a very old or minor dereliction, it may be used to dismiss the claim. I had one client who worked for a company for 10 years, but the company was able to demonstrate that the employee had lied on the original application form, and the case was dismissed. The employee was fired.
So this comes down to my performance.
It may, yes.
He frowned. What did they have on him?
She is solving a problem, too. So, what is the problem she is solving?
Beside him, Fernandez pulled the tape recorder out of her pocket.
There's a couple of other things I want to go over, she said. There's something that happens early on in the tape.
Okay.
I want you to listen.
She gave the player to him. He held it close to his ear.
he heard his own voice saying clearly, "We'll face that later. I've given her your thoughts, and she's talking to Bob now, so presumably we'll go into the meeting tomorrow taking that position. Well, anyway, Mark, if there is a significant change in all this, I'll contact you before the meeting tomorrow, and..."
"Forget that phone,"
Meredith's voice said loudly, and then there was the sound of rustling, like fabric, and a sort of hissing sound, and a dull thunk as the phone was dropped. The momentary sharp crackle of static. More rustling. Then silence. A grunt. Rustling. As he listened, he tried to imagine the action in the room. They must have moved over to the couch, because now the voices were lower, less distinct. He heard himself say, "Meredith, wait."
"Oh, God," she said, "I've wanted you all day."
More rustling. Heavy breathing. It was hard to be certain what was happening. A little moan from her. More rustling. She said,
"Oh, God, you feel so good. I can't stand the bastard touching me. Those stupid glasses. Oh, I'm so hot. I haven't had a decent fuck."
More rustling. Static. Crackle. Rustling. More rustling. Sanders listened with a sense of disappointment. He could not really create images for what was going on, and he had been there. This tape would not be persuasive to someone else. Most of it sounded like obscure noise, with long periods of silence. "Meredith?"
"Oh, don't talk. No, no."
He heard her gasping in little breaths. Then more silence. Fernandez said,
"That's enough."
Sanders put the player down and shut it off. He shook his head. "You can't tell anything from this, about what was really going on."
"You can tell enough," Fernandez said, "and don't you start worrying about the evidence. That's my job. But you heard her first statements?"
She consulted her notepad.
"Where she says, 'I've wanted you all day,' and then she says, 'Oh God, you feel so good, I can't stand the bastard touching me. Those stupid glasses, oh, I'm so hot, I haven't had a decent fuck.' You heard that part?"
"Yes, I heard it."
"Okay. Who is she talking about?"
"Talking about?"
"Yes. Who is the bastard she can't stand touching her?"
"I assume her husband," Sanders said. "We were talking about him earlier, before the tape."
"Tell me what was said earlier."
"Well, Meredith was complaining about having to pay alimony to her husband, and then she said her husband was terrible in bed. She said, 'I hate a man who doesn't know what he's doing.'"
"So you think 'I can't stand the bastard touching me' refers to her husband?"
"Yes."
"I don't," Fernandez said. "They were divorced months ago. The divorce was bitter. The husband hates her. He has a girlfriend now. He's taken her to Mexico. I don't think she means the husband."
"Then who?"
"I don't know."
Sanders said, "I suppose it could be anybody."
"I don't think it's just anybody. Listen again. Listen to how she sounds."
He rewound the tape, held the player to his ear. After a moment, he put the player down. "She sounds almost angry." Fernandez nodded.
"Resentful is the term I'd use. She's in the midst of this episode with you, and she's talking about someone else. The bastard. It's as if she wants to pay somebody back. Right at that moment, she's getting even."
Sanders said, "I don't know. Meredith's a talker. She always talked about other people. Old boyfriends, that stuff. She's not what you'd call a romantic." He remembered one time when they were lying on the bed in the apartment in Sunnyvale, feeling a sort of relaxed glow.
A Sunday afternoon,
listening to kids laughing in the street outside, his hand resting on her thigh, feeling the sweat. And in this thoughtful way, she said,
"You know, I once went out with this Norwegian guy, and he had a curved dick. Curved like a sword, sort of bent over to the side, and he..."
"Jesus, Meredith."
"What's the matter? It's true, he really did."
"Not now." Whenever this sort of thing happened, she'd sigh, as if she was obliged to put up with his excessive sensitivity.
Why is it that guys always want to think they're the only ones?
We don't. We know we're not. Just not now, okay?
And she'd sigh again. Sitting in the restaurant, Fernandez said, "Even if it's not unusual for her to talk during sex, even if she is indiscreet or distancing, who is she talking about here?"
Sanders shook his head. "I don't know, Louise."
"And she says she can't stand him touching her, as if she has no choice. And she mentions his silly glasses." She looked over at Meredith, who was eating quietly with Garvin.
"Him?" "I don't think so."
"Why not?"
"Everybody says no. Everybody says Bob isn't screwing her."
"Everybody could be wrong."
Sanders shook his head. "It'd be incest."
"You're probably right." The food came. Sanders poked at his pasta puttanesca, picking out the olives. He wasn't feeling hungry. Beside him, Fernandez ate heartily. They had ordered the same thing. Sanders looked over at the Conley white people. Nichols was holding up a clear plastic sheet of 35mm transparencies. Slides. Of what, he wondered. His half-frame glasses were perched on his nose. He seemed to be taking a long time. Beside him, Conley glanced at his watch and said something about the time. The others nodded. Conley glanced over at Johnson, then turned back to his papers. Daly said something. "Have that figure?"
"It's here," Conley said, pointing to the sheet.
"This is really very good," Fernandez said. "You shouldn't let it get cold."
"Okay."
He took a bite. It had no taste. He put the fork down. She wiped her chin with her napkin. "You know, you never really told me why you stopped. At the end."
"My friend Max Dorfman says I set it all up."
"Uh-huh," Fernandez said.
"Do you think that, too?"
"I don't know. I was just asking what you were feeling at the time. At the time you pulled away."
He shrugged. "I just didn't want to."
"Uh-huh. Didn't feel like it when you got there, huh?"
"No, I didn't."
Then he said, "You really want to know what it was?" She coughed.
"She coughed?" Fernandez said.
Sanders saw himself again in the room, his trousers down around his knees, bent over Meredith on the office couch. He remembered thinking, "What the hell am I doing?" And she had her hands on his shoulders, tugging him toward her. "Oh, please, no, no." And then she turned her head aside and coughed. That cough was what did it. That was when he sat back and said, "You're right," and got off the couch. Fernandez frowned.
"I have to say," Fernandez said, "a cough doesn't seem like a big deal."
It was. He pushed his plate away. "I mean, you can't cough at a time like that."
"Why? Is this some etiquette I don't know about?" Fernandez said. "No coughing in the clinch?"
"It's not that at all," Sanders said. "It's just what it means."
"I'm sorry, you've lost me. What does a cough mean?"
End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.